You're listening to the Warren Weeks Show podcast.
So he walked up to this thing calling out, okay, Yankee boys, come on out. I'll give you a hand fixing your broken down flying machine. And he had heard some voices coming from inside that really was convincing him what it was. But as soon as he called out, the voices stopped. But he was right next to this thing. He reached out with his rubberized glove hand, which melted because of the heat on this thing. The whole thing rotated and a blast of hot gas hit him in the chest, setting his clothes on fire, setting fire to the pine needles, and the thing took off, and he was left to fend for himself.
Thanks to TV and movies, when most people think about UFOs, they think of the United States. But believe it or not, Canada has been a hotbed for UFO sightings for many decades. My guest today is Canada's foremost expert on UFOs, and he's written 10 books on the subject. But this is no tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist. He approaches the topic with the training of a scientist and the stance of a skeptic. I really enjoyed this chat. This is my conversation with Chris Rutkowski. Thanks again for doing this. I understand you retired recently from working in the communications world for almost 50 years. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Yeah. In fact, I did some media training and media management for faculty and people like that. So this is sort of right in there.
Oh, nice. So we've got some overlap in our careers. Yeah. So that's a long time. You worked there 47 years. My dad had a furniture store in Northern Ontario for the exact same amount of time. So I'm well aware of what an amazing career that is. Before we even jump into any of the UFO stuff, and I know you've written 9 books and you've been studying this since the 70s. And every time I
do... Ten, actually.
Have you really? Is it 10 now? Wow.
Yeah.
Every time I search anywhere about UFOs in Canada, all roads kind of lead to you. So this is a really cool conversation I've been looking forward to. How did that work when you had this very kind of formal communications job for this large institution and your kind of side gig was in the realm that it's in? Was that... Did that ever present any conflicts or weirdness for you?
Not especially. My degrees, and one of the reasons I kept staying at the university for so long was because I got 2 degrees while I was working, sort of, on part-time on weekends and whatever. I got my first degree in science, specializing in astronomy, and then my master's degree in education, specializing in science education. So it actually fit in perfectly because I was a science writer, communicating scientific discovery and research and so forth through my job. And the UFO stuff, I think, was not uncomfortable for me as much as it was for my employer. And we just sort of had this tacit agreement not to really talk about it all that much. And I made a very concentrated effort not to have the two overlap. I mean, this was clearly something I did on my own. It had nothing to do with the university as such. However, a couple of times there was some recognition. In fact, the university awarded me a service award for education in the field of science, specializing in UFOs. So they did recognize that eventually it did contribute to something. And then about 5 years ago, I was approached by the head of archives within the libraries if I would be interested in donating my collection of UFO papers and books and materials to archives for posterity, kind of as a historical collection. And most people are probably not aware that University of Manitoba has one of the largest collections of materials on paranormal science and events and arts and so forth anywhere in the world. In fact, I think there are upwards of about 50 separate collections now. And even Dan Aykroyd's father, who was actually a ghost hunter, his collection is at the University of Manitoba, and other collections that had been contributed around the world. So it kind of fit in with what they were doing. And so I have actually donated all of my UFO-related books, some 2,000 or 3,000, and files amounting to something like 25,000 to 30,000 separate UFO reports to the university, and be a sort of being mined for researchers wanting to know more about what was going on in Canada for quite some time.
So Dan Aykroyd's father was a ghost hunter, and he turned into a ghost buster.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Yeah.
So, but you must have had someone over those years come up to you, one of your colleagues or someone in the university come up to you and say, "Hey, Chris, you know, on the weekend, me and the wife saw something." You know, you must have had some of that, no?
Oh, absolutely. There was this, I think the term used was invisible college, where I did actually have some academic scholars who I would talk to from time to time, and they would confer with me about what's going on in the field of UFOs and what's the latest case and what are you working on. And people, you know, continually employees and staff and faculty would come up to me and say, you know, we were out at the lake and we saw something, what did we see, and so forth. So even though, you know, there's this, I don't know, taboo in terms of official interest, a lot of people were interested in what I was doing because, and this is a very important to note, I was not the type of person interested in UFOs who is sort of stereotypical, where, you know, stay up late at night, drive vans around, and wear pyramids on my head, and, you know, like in the movie Signs, have tinfoil hats and that type of thing. You know, I wasn't going around saying that the aliens are here, you know, run for your lives, that type of thing. I was looking at it from a purely scientific point of view. In fact, my scientific methodology helps me in trying to understand what's going on. So because I was dealing with it in quite a serious way, I've actually ended up giving presentations to academics at the university and other universities on what I've found. And so, you know, as long as the, you know, the approach is soundly scientific and the methodology is good, there's no reason why this couldn't be part of academia. And in fact, what we've seen over the past 5 years or so is that more and more scientists are coming out of the closet, so to speak, and have professed an interest in UFOs and are fascinated in trying to help. And a number of scientific societies have sprung up, the most notably one called the Galileo Project, headed by a professor named Avi Loeb. And he's brought on board astrophysicists and engineers and historians and lots of people from the technical aspects as well as the science to better understand what's going on in terms of unidentified aerial phenomena. So it's really becoming one of its own these days.
Now, that Avi Loeb guy you mentioned, wasn't he the guy who identified that thing he called like a sail or something that was kind of flying through our solar system or galaxy?
Yeah, his view is that the orbit of this this object was actually an interstellar object, a chunk of rock that may have not have been rock, you know, it could have been something manufactured, that, you know, came from way beyond our solar system, unlike most asteroids which come from within our solar system, and passed fairly close to Earth, astronomically speaking, and then out again. And he believes it, you know, might have been an interstellar manufactured object of some sort. But, you know, he's hedging his bets. He's saying, well, let's see what this is. And as a matter of fact, a second such object entered Earth's orbit and appears to have exploded and crashed off the coast of New Guinea. And he's actually organizing an expedition to search the ocean floor for pieces of whatever this was in, I think, as early as March. Wow. Of this year. So, you know, there's a serious scientific interest to try and better understand our place in the universe and our things from outside our solar system visiting us, and are any of them interstellar and possibly manufactured.
So during the pandemic, I think it was the Pentagon that came out, either the Department of Defense, the Pentagon came out and said essentially that there are these crafts that we've been seeing for many years. The videos of, you know, Commander David Fravor came online, the 60 Minutes interview and the Tic Tac. And essentially, it was such a weird time, though, because we're in the middle of this pandemic and the Tiger King and the vaccination stuff, and the world is in such turmoil, and it just kind of seemed to slip under the radar, and everyone's like, oh yeah, you know, kind of makes sense. But that was a pretty groundbreaking thing. And I still don't know if it's really made its way into the general public. How big of an announcement is that to someone like you who's been studying this stuff for so many years?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think it is in the general public. I mean, there's already memes about it. And it's showing up in so many ways. Mainstream media does usually play a clip of one of those videos whenever it does a UFO story. And there was even one just last week about that had nothing to do with that particular incident, but they played the clip anyway. So it's really in the public eye, I think. And it was fairly significant for the Pentagon to come out and say, you know, we're taking this seriously. And, you know, we do have pilots reporting things. As a matter of fact, just last week, the Pentagon came out with a long-awaited report from something called the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, which is investigating unidentified aerial phenomena, but reports only from military personnel. And, you know, the fact that they are now actually encouraging and asking military personnel who have seen unusual objects to report them without any fear of damage to their reputations or whatever. You know, there's still a bit of a stigma that they, you know, receive something like 360 reports from military personnel over the course of about 18 months. And that suggests that, you know, there are things that are being seen by military personnel far and beyond what the general public are reporting, because there's many, many more of those. But it shows that, you know, the interest is there, and the Pentagon is at least taking it seriously to the point where they're considering, you know, are these drones? Are this an intrusion by another foreign power? Is it something technical? Is there a glitch somewhere? Are pilots hallucinating? Or is it, in fact, something else that we can't identify? And that gets people's imaginations really going. And, you know, whether it's aliens or something else, that's what the Pentagon is trying to understand. As a matter of fact, Avi Loeb and his Galileo project are part and parcel of that as well, trying to set up observation stations to get instrumented data to see if they can catch any of these objects so we can better understand what people are seeing.
What's your take on that specific one, like the ones that the military has been seeing in the same videos that we've seen? I think they were from 2004. They're quite old, but given your body of knowledge and the work you've done and the kind of skepticism you bring to it from that scientific part of you, what's your take on that? Is that like, what do you think those things are?
Well, yeah. And I guess I've been called a skeptic by hardcore believers, and a skeptic call me too much of a believer. But I guess I'm an objective skeptic. I don't know. I don't buy the videos completely, and the reason I don't is because they're just clips. We don't have all the accompanying information. As a matter of fact, the audio that was usually aired with the video doesn't actually match what was seen in the video. They're actually separate pieces. Two of those videos were actually on the same night, and we don't have the intervening video. Like, it's they're clips that are like an hour apart or something like that. Well, what was happening during that period? Well, if they were continually under observation. And so we don't actually have enough information. As a matter of fact, we don't have data from the Pentagon. We have numbers. I think the latest number they're throwing around is something like 500 or 510 separate reports received, you know, over the past number of years. But what does that represent? Are those objects that haven't been explained? How many were by pilots? You know, what time of day? Is there any way they could be drones? What was, you know, where exactly was this happening? We do know that these videos were taking place in areas where there are known military exercises. As a matter of fact, off the coast of California near Catalina Island, there actually is a drone base operated by the Pentagon. So, you know, I'm wondering, how do they rule that out, and did they actually rule that out, or are these just numbers that are being thrown around? So I need more data, and this is my scientific training. I need the data, and we have not been given the data yet. And that's to me, you know, necessary before we can say, yes, these are definitely alien spacecraft, or no, these are definitely drones being flown by China or Russia. Hmm.
You talk about numbers. And so I, you know, knowing that we were going to speak, I got your book, Canada's UFOs Declassified. I think, is that your most recent one?
Yes.
And I have to say, it was a really interesting read, because I'm going through it. And for anyone, You went through all of these archives of all of these reports from a certain, I think it was 1947 to 1981 or something along those lines.
Yeah.
2,940 sightings in Canada. And so when people think UFOs and UFO sightings and stories, we always think of the United States, and there's some really famous stories from there. And you even mentioned in the book that the topic has been less culturally potent in Canada, but it doesn't mean there's been any shortage of sightings. And I found some of the instances, like I was literally saying to my girlfriend, "Oh my God, you won't believe this." And "Oh my God, you won't believe this." It's probably irritating her, but some of these stories are bananas. Like in March of 1969, there's a UFO sighting near the Prime Minister's residence in Canada. That would be, you would think more people would know about this, or an Air Canada airplane being followed by a UFO. People seeing these things hovering outside their farms and their fields, and they leave these big holes in the ground afterwards. Like, and it's just story after story after story after story. Now, you said a bunch of them could be written off to, you know, anomalies, astronomical events, you know, maybe just some crazy people mixed in there. But there's a fair number of them that are, there was no logical explanation, and so they're in that other category that they might have been something.
Well, sure. And through your reading, you probably discovered also that a lot of the cases happen to RCMP officers, to military personnel, to pilots, people who are, you know, on whose lives we depend for good observational capabilities. And if they're seeing things that are a little strange, or in some cases very strange, you know, you have to take notice. And the other thing, you know, these are referred to as stories, but these are actual documents, government documents, reported by military personnel, from police, investigated by the RCMP. And the source of this was a group of documents in Library and Archives Canada. There's something like 9,000 separate documents covering that period, which is a significant period. But these are things that are actually recorded. And in some cases, there are transcripts of the interviews between the RCMP and the witnesses. There are official documents in Ottawa involving discussions at a fairly high level, things that are happening at in National Defense, where presentations were given to the Minister of National Defense at the time. And, you know, this is not just, you know, a story that you might see on a tabloid. This is actually recorded as having really happened. You know, the fact that there were UFOs seen over the Prime Minister's residence. You just, I mean, imagine if there was a series of UFOs seen over the White House. You know, and you'd probably hear a lot more about it.
Yeah.
But in Canada, it happens. You know, one of those things. Just probably nothing.
A lot of the stories actually struck me as sort of just Canadian in quotes. Like someone would see something, basically a UFO on their property, but they didn't want to report it because they didn't want to bother anybody. Like there's these very Canadian kind of approaches. you mentioned the Minister of Defense. There's some references in your book to Paul Hellyer, former Minister of National Defense, I think under the original like Pierre Trudeau. And I'd be interested in your take on this guy, because obviously I don't know the guy, and just from reading it, you can make a couple inferences. So in 2005, and again, this is not just some guy off the street, former Minister of National Defense for Canada, who had a quote that UFOs are as real as the airplanes over our heads. And then a number of years later, in 2021, before his death, he made a statement that, and I think they changed the name to UFPs. They're, again, part of the stigma.
Yeah.
They're the most important topic on the planet, and working with aliens to save Earth is essential to the survival of humanity. And he's claimed that aliens have visited the Earth many times, and that his thinking was that when they saw that human beings had figured out the atomic bomb, they decided that we were doing some serious shit and they needed to come and kind of check us out. So that's an interesting story to me, because here you have someone at the highest levels of government control and power and credibility making these claims that sound a little bananas. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, yeah. And Paul Hellyer, he's achieved cult status. He was actually, you know, practically godlike in some of the views of pop ufology, and I call it pop ufology. This is, you know, what people generally consider, and it's all the stuff that makes the great headlines and is covered in a lot of stuff. The problem is, that Paul Hellyer was in fact the Minister of Defense, but he was only Minister of Defense up until 1967. And in fact, just the first half of 1967. After that point, he, did hold some positions of political power. Eventually, was on the Privy Council, but his security clearance vanished as soon as he was out of Minister of Defense. As a matter of fact, most ministers of defense don't have the highest security clearance. They actually have to apply for special privileges. But Paul Hellyer wouldn't have been in the inside knowledge circle after 1967. And yet here we have him in the 2000s making these absurd claims about aliens visiting Earth. He actually said on one interview that his inside knowledge, somebody told him that aliens are being held in Area 51 and an underground base in Nevada. And for entertainment, they sort of put themselves in disguise and walk around Las Vegas. And I mean, his claims got more absurd as the years went on. And the thing is, he really didn't have any inside knowledge or privilege after the 60s, you know, so 50 years later to make these absurd claims. So I actually was on a couple of interviews with him. One was on TVO where he and I were on a panel, and I asked him bluntly about, you know, some of this stuff, and he just claimed that he had insider knowledge. And I, you know, I've been at this for quite a number of years, and I've spoken to ministers and, you know, relatively current ministers of defense have looked at my material, and I was actually referred to in a recent briefing to in National Defense. So I have trouble believing those stories because they seem to come from pop culture rather than any serious information. At the same time, you know, the fact that we did have a former Minister of Defense making these claims and getting interested got a lot of people interested in the subject, which, you know, I in some ways would be a very good thing. The reality is that in Canada, the subject of UFOs or UAPs or whatever you might want to call them is being taken fairly seriously. To the point where, you know, the National Research Council of Canada had the Royal Canadian Mounted Police investigating UFO reports for them up until 1995. And after that point, responsibility was transferred to Transport Canada, which to this day publishes incident reports of pilots seeing UFOs, not anything else, specifically unidentified flying objects. Those reports are available, and I have, you know, literally hundreds upon hundreds of them. As a matter of fact, since just the year 2000, there's something like 500 separate UFO reports from pilots and, you know, airport personnel that have been recorded in Canada alone. And just on January 11th of this year, in 2023, a pilot who was flying between Labrador and to the main island of Newfoundland reported to Transport Canada a series of lights that he couldn't identify actually over the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And that was recorded. So these reports continually are being made and are being made and taken seriously. So on the one hand, there are absurd claims that are, you know, out there. But on the other hand, there are serious attempts to try and understand what's going on. Although the degree to which things are being investigated is, you know, is still up for debate.
So it sounds like the Paul Hellyer, I think you're being diplomatic and polite, but basically saying he might have been a little unstable mentally.
Well, actually, one of his books, one that most people don't have, documents his retirement life in Muskoka. And he was with some friends sitting around at his cabin, and they all saw this UFO fly overhead. And in his book, he actually says, yeah, it was probably, you know, too much whiskey that we were drinking at the time. So you have to temper a lot of what we read about Paul Hellyer to some of the realities.
The other thing I found really interesting from the book was that crop circles, which people, I think, originally, you know, folklore and just general consensus is that they were first discovered, I think, in the UK. But your book outlines that they were actually discovered many, many years before right here in Canada.
Yeah, you know, and they weren't called crop circles at the time, although they were called UFO landing traces. In 1967, some markings were found out in a field near Duhamel, Alberta. And it was actually investigated by the Royal Canadian Air Force, taken very seriously. In fact, a formal report on the on what was found was published by the Department of National Defense. And it was concluded that whatever made them must have come from above, and they actually had calculations on, you know, the pressure that whatever it was might have made on the soil, and they actually had photographs of these rings in the field. Nobody had actually seen any UFOs making them. That's just, these were just discovered in a field one day. You know, it was taken very seriously, and the first official crop circles were investigated by the Royal Canadian Air Force years before they were found in England.
See, we should be turning this into a tourism site and kind of, you know, monetize this, get a little capital market, a little capitalism going.
How did it is kind of in that, in that not that far from Duhamel, Alberta, St. Paul, Alberta, is what was billed as the world's first UFO landing site for a Centennial Project, also in 1967. The town of St. Paul, Alberta, built this raised UFO landing pad for flying saucers to land on. It's still there today. There's actually a museum where you can report your UFOs and look at a traveling exhibit from the United States, from one of the UFO groups, with photos and artifacts and so forth. And Mother Teresa herself visited the landing pad to bless it, and held a mass there, or helped say a mass there, and said that, you know, if there's our sick and needy creatures and people in outer space, we should help them too. So we do have a little bit of that going on in Canada.
Man, how did you first get into this? It, like, we're talking like a half century ago, you started into this. There must have been a movie, a book, something that you saw.
Well, you know, back in the mid-70s, and this does date me a bit, I was just starting university. And at that time, there were a lot of UFOs that were being seen in Canada and some in my home province of Manitoba. I was curious. I, at that time, was already a super geek and was part of the astronomy club. When I entered university, I went into astronomy. My prof at the time in university, like most astronomers, was not all that impressed with the whole UFO thing. It was all nonsense. People were lying or drunk or something. So when calls would come into the astronomy department from people who wanted to talk to somebody about what they had seen, he was not too enamored with it. But I remember a call came in one time while I was actually in his office. And he was a little annoyed. And I said, you know what, why don't I take the call for you? You know, these types of calls, they're curious. And I thought I could get on his good graces in some way. So he says, sure, because my study carrel was literally around the corner from his office. So the calls would come in and I'd take them. And I ended up talking with people who had seen UFOs. I wanted to know what it was that people were seeing, what all the fuss was all about. And, you know, I could explain most of them, stars, planets, planes, you know, whatever. But I would go out into the countryside to visit people in their farmhouses. And I found that, you know, they weren't as crazy as I was told they were. They seemed to be honest, sincere people who'd simply seen some things. And there were some cases I couldn't explain, which was puzzling to me. And as a scientist, okay, there has to be some way to solve this mystery. But there were a handful that were just plain unexplainable. And that didn't mean that the aliens were here. I just didn't know what these things were. And after this had gone on for a number of months, one of the things that was happening in the physics department at the time, and that's where the astronomy department was that every Friday afternoon, there was a departmental meeting just in the boardroom where researchers would, you know, present some interesting aspects of something in the cyclotron or a new particle that had been discovered or something like that. And somebody canceled. And so my prof came to me and said, you know, we need somebody at the last minute. Why don't you tell people what you found out from talking about UFOs? It's always in the news anyways. So I said, okay, very unusual for an undergraduate to give a presentation at a departmental meeting. So I said, sure. And then just before I was about to, the day before, my prop came to me and said, you know, words got around that you're going to be talking about UFOs, and, you know, the media want to show up, and the public want to come and hear it. So we're going to move you out of the department boardroom to the largest lecture hall in the entire campus, something like 400 or 500 people. And it was baptism by fire. I became the UFO guy overnight. And that's how it started.
Wow. So cool. And the fact that you're still at it all these years later, obviously there's got to be a passion or something that you're trying to find. You know, when you're lying there in bed, going to sleep at night, staring at the ceiling, after all of that time and all of those, you've probably done more research on this than maybe almost everyone in the world. What's your take? Like, is this stuff real? Are there aliens? What's going on? What's out there?
Well, sure. A lot of people get into this because they've seen something, and you know, I haven't. I've never had the classic UFO experience or anything like that. But I'm fascinated from the point of view of science, and you know, science is an avenue of discovery, and to try and better understand our universe, and in some cases, better understand who we are and what makes people tick. And you know, if there are no UFOs, if there's no such thing, physical object as UFOs, and the phenomenon is not a physical phenomenon, at the very least, it's a psychological or a sociological phenomenon. And in any of those three instances, it should be studied by science. And so I think the fact that for so many years, science ignored it or tried to push it aside or pretend that it didn't exist, was doing a disservice to the many people who had seen things. And I'm fascinated by the UFO phenomenon in general, the books, the magazines, certainly the reports themselves, but the conventions, the videos that are being produced, the many people I've spoken to whose lives are completely wrapped up in this whole phenomenon and live and breathe UFOs. They make pilgrimages to UFO sites and so forth. And the fact that we have tourism in St. Paul, Alberta, and Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, and a few other places just in Canada alone, that shows that there's this quest for our understanding of who we are in the universe has always been there. But this kind of brings it down to earth, pun intended, I suppose, that, you know, are we alone? Are we trying to, you know, impress our ways of thinking and our believing in the universe on the universe itself? Maybe, you know, we are special after all, if we feel a little bit underappreciated or a little bit small looking at the vastness of the universe. If aliens out there are really existing and they want to come visit us, you know, maybe there's some reason for us to hope, and maybe aliens can, you know, solve some of the problems we can't, like in Star Trek, where they've solved war and, you know, they feed millions. There's no famine, there's no war. It's all peace and the ultimate quest for knowledge. You know, maybe aliens have figured that out. So maybe if they can help us figure out what's going on down on Earth, we certainly can't figure it out, apparently. So, you know, we look to a sort of a savior mentality. And I've written chapters and books on the religious aspect of UFOs, where, you know, this is in fact a religion in some ways, where aliens replace deities, where, because of course they can travel throughout the universe without any trouble. They have powers that surpass ours. They have knowledge that surpass ours. And their message to us from contactees and abductees is, you know, stop war, have peace, try to attain spiritual enlightenment and so forth, which is, you know, very much in terms of religion. So you combine that with the actual reports by pilots over Canadian airspace, for example, and you've got this dichotomy of is it all spiritual? Is it all physical? Is there a sort of an in-between that we have to take into account? I mean, it does shape who we are, and there is a physical component.
So people are going to be angry if I don't ask you about Area 51. I know this is the thing that everyone just beats to death, but this is probably the most famous incident where, there's this apparent crash landing. And supposedly it makes it into the news that a UFO landed in this guy's field. And the next day the government kind of backtracks it, weather balloon. And obviously they have this huge, very secret facility in Nevada. And not that you have any special, inside knowledge, or they've bust you in there, but what's your take on that one? Do you think there was something to it, or do you think this is just a secret government lab and the UFO stuff is just folklore? What's your read on that?
Well, what happened in Roswell in 1947 is a big matter of debate. Of course, anybody with intimate knowledge of that is long gone. There's no actual government documentation that says anything happened. There was a series of incidents, and there's a classic case where the government said, "Oh, we have a crash saucer," and then the next hour or so they said, "No, it was just a weather balloon or some testing balloon." We do know that in the area in Roswell, it was the location of the first nuclear facility, or the first nuclear
test that they did.
A test. Well, it was where the first planes were working and so forth. There was actually Operation Paperclip, which occurred in the area at the time, where they took the German scientists working on the V1s and V2s from Germany and brought them to the United States to work on rockets here. Though that occurred in that particular area, so it was actually quite interesting that was occurring in that area at that time. As far as Area 51 goes, it's a secret test facility. Lots of interesting things come out of there. Certainly the B-1s and other stealth technology was developed there. People have long, seen lights flying, zipping around over there. It's a secret military test facility. Of course, there's going to be some strange stuff going around out there. Whether they have, an underground base with aliens in it, we certainly have no proof or evidence of that. There's some great stories and great rumors, but beyond that, we simply don't know. Now, one can imagine, though, that, as more and more people, including military personnel, reported seeing objects in the skies that didn't seem to behave in ways that were like aircraft that we know of, that the United States would have taken an interest. And, of course, this was during the Cold War. And are the Russians, in fact, developing something that we don't have, flying things that at speeds that we can't attain and hovering capability and so forth. So, there was natural that the United States military machine was curious about this, and it makes sense that they would be developing things in a secret test range. So beyond what we know, it's all speculation. They're great stories, though, you have to admit.
Huh. And that brings me then next to the Bob Lazar. Obviously, you must know who this guy is. And for anyone who doesn't, there's an individual, a scientist, who said that he worked at a facility near or associated with Area 51, S4, I believe, and said that he was reverse engineering alien technology. his story came out in 1989 because he had been sort of outed from the program. I guess he had brought some friends to look at some craft taking off, and there was a situation where I think his wife was having an affair with one of the pilots on the, like, it's kind of messy. They were monitoring the phone calls, and so his employers found out about it. That's his story anyway. Anyway, he thought that he was in mortal danger for spilling some secrets. And so he went out and did basically a news interview where I think he had his identity kind of shielded and talked about all this stuff. And then he came out and outed himself shortly thereafter. This is like, 30 years ago. The stories remained remarkably consistent over the years. He doesn't seem like someone, as an observer, I've watched, the Netflix series and some interviews and podcasts that he's done. He doesn't seem like someone who's just doing this for attention. It seems almost the reverse, like he doesn't want this. When you look at all of the information that he has spoken about and the stories that he's had and, the drawings and the, Element 115 claims, what's your take on the Bob Lazar story? Is this another situation kind of like Paul Hellyer, or do you think there's something to this?
Well, I'll say right at the outset, no, I don't buy the story at all. And there's several reasons for that. You've probably heard that, you know, the claim that there's no record of him graduating from MIT or from his high school. He can't remember any of his professors' names. They don't recall him at all. And the interpretation is, well, they wiped him. You know, they tried to cover this up. That's pretty ridiculous because, you know, most of us can remember at least a few of our profs' names from back then. But also that this element 115, he said that he smuggled out some of this element 115, which back then, before it was actually discovered, and we actually know what element 115 is now, he said that he smuggled it out, had it in a briefcase, and he took it out of the lab, secret area 51 lab, says that eventually had to give it back. Well, we know what element 115 was. Since then, it has been discovered, but only a few atoms of it have been created, and even then only under very high energy containment. So the fact that he says that he smuggled it out in a briefcase is silly on a number of levels. One, that you probably wouldn't have a briefcase full of element 115. And if it's a really secure base to the point where they're covering you up, could you really, really smuggle out a piece of element 115 if it's that top secret? And furthermore, you know, there's a story about the FBI raided his home and lab and whatever. Well, he actually had a company which was selling radioactive materials through the mail. Some of the elements that he was selling were actually the same that were used in other countries for poisoning political opponents. The reason why FBI raided his home is because, you know, there's something funny going on here for somebody who's selling radioactive materials through the mail. So there's a lot of really weird elements to that. From a scientific point of view, the physics doesn't make sense. And, they say that they don't have any record of him ever working there, although somebody later found a record of him being in a, you know, in one phone book anyways. So he may have had a low level security clearance, for doing some minor, technical work, but certainly wouldn't have had any access to anything really important. So I suspect the story is made up. A lot of people believe it. The film that came out about him is very entertaining and seems to push the narrative. But if you really dig down, I suspect there's not much there.
Interesting. That makes me kind of sad. I wanted to believe that.
And it's all about belief, isn't it? And, you know, we the desire to believe is very, very strong, and people will go to great lengths to believe. I was having a discussion, just as a matter of fact, yesterday online, because of this report from January the 11th about these lights that were seen. Transport Canada actually classified this as laser interference, because pilots often report lasers being shone at them. In this case, it certainly was not that, but I made that comment. And a fellow who had seen UFOs elsewhere in Canada said that, he regularly shines lasers at UFOs that are flying over his home. And, he knows the difference between a plane and a UFO, and it's okay. Don't worry, he knows. And I said, no, you don't know. And you're the reason why pilots report seeing this type of thing. And he says, no, I know exactly, you are a disbeliever. I know what a difference between a UFO and a plane, because he believes that UFOs are flying over his home when in fact they're aircraft. And I couldn't convince him otherwise. And this power of belief is so strong in so many people that it does lead them to go down rabbit holes. And when you've got reinforcement of that through a lot of media, a lot of sensationalism, it really does lead people astray, and it just destroys a lot of the credibility of the subject, which is one reason why a lot of media aren't paying attention to the UFO phenomenon, even though there is some really good data in there and some good cases and some good reasons for studying the UFO phenomenon.
But sticking with the Bob Lazar thing for just a little bit, you know, he did predict element 115 before it was created. That's something. You know, I've predicted zero elements that have come to fruition. And and then if you think about motive, it's not like the guy is raking in a bunch of cash or he's on the conference tour. Like, it seems, and you know, maybe it's an act, but it seems to me whenever I see this guy speak that this is like an albatross around his neck, that he wishes that this never happened. So I don't know. I still like, and the fact that over three decades, his story has remained exactly the same. If he was BSing, he's very good at it.
Well, he may have predicted element 115, but physical scientists had predicted element 115 for many, many years as well. So I don't see that as a motivation there. But I mean, the fact that his story hasn't changed, it has. There are things that have been adapted, but is it possible, and this has been floated, that he was duped? He was a stooge by counter espionage to, you know, muddy the water about what was really going on at Area 51 so that nobody would ever believe what was going on there. There's alternative explanations for everything. And as I say, I think there's enough smoke to say there really was smoke. Okay.
So in the U.S., there are some really famous cases. Well, obviously, Roswell is a huge one. Barney and Betty Hill in 1961 claiming that they were abducted. You have Travis Walton, the guy who in, I think it was 75, disappeared for like 4 or 5 days and then came back. There's movies about this. Canada's got pretty similar stories as well. But again, I don't know if it's our marketing department or our just Canadian shyness, but when you are at a cocktail party or you're talking to people who don't really know about the Canadian stories, and again, your book was a great resource for these, and you've got some of the actual documents that you talked about, the reports are in the book. You can see in actual people, like you can see the typing. It's really cool. But what are the kind of top two or three Canadian stories that kind of resonate with you over the years?
Well, you know, if for introducing people to what was going on in Canada, you know, I have to point to one of the famous cases, Falcon Lake, 1967, May long weekend, where a fellow named Stefan Mihalik, who a bit of a rock hound, very interested in, rocks and nature and that type of thing. He had gone to a kind of a rugged, out of the way area of Manitoba near the Ontario border, a bit of a Canadian shield, very rocky. Was doing some amateur prospecting, and you know, there are actually some silver and gold ore deposits in there. So you know, he's trying to find his luck. But around lunchtime, he had stopped to eat a sandwich, and he was surprised when there were these bright lights in the sky. One of these lights came closer and closer, and eventually landed on a rock outcropping. Not far from him, it was resolved to a classic Hollywood-style flying saucer, about 35 feet across, 12 feet high, domed, flashing lights, the whole thing. He was very curious. He actually had a military background. He thought this was perhaps an American test project, because obviously there's no such things as flying saucers and aliens. As a matter of fact, too, until his death, he never talked in terms about aliens. He thought this was some sort of a military project. But this was about the time of the beginning of the Apollo program. There was in the news the tragic Apollo 1 accident where astronauts were killed about going to the moon. So we figured maybe this is a test thing and it's broken down and they have to come in for repairs in Canada. So he walked up to this thing calling out, "Okay, Yankee boys, come on out. I'll give you a hand fixing your broken down flying machine." And he had heard some voices coming from inside that really was convincing him what it was. But as soon as he called out, the voices stopped and he figured maybe it's not Americans, maybe it's a Russian. So he happened to be multilingual. He called out in Russian and a few other languages. But he was right next to this thing. He reached out with his rubberized glove hand, which melted because of the heat on this thing. The whole thing rotated and a blast of hot gas hit him in the chest, setting his clothes on fire, setting fire to the pine needles, and the thing took off. And he was left to fend for himself. Well, he eventually sought medical help as soon as he could, staggered out of the bush. Got to Winnipeg, where he was examined by emergency physicians at the hospital. He was concerned that other people might be hurt by such things, so he notified the media. He said, "Don't go out there. There's this danger to people." Story came out. The RCMP investigated. The RCAF investigated. The United States Air Force came up to investigate as well. We have recovered something like 300 or 400 separate pages of documentation in government records about this case. He went to the Mayo Clinic to be have a complete physical and psychological examination. He was taken to atomic energy installation in Pinawa to see if he was burned by radiation, which he wasn't, but he had burns on his body that recurred from time to time, as if he was allergic and some toxin was being processed through his body. It was studied. The case was analyzed 7 ways from Sunday. There was radiation found at the site. A chunk of metal was found at the site, and he was convinced that it was some sort of American secret weapon that he was injured by. Very, very strange. The case was actually profiled on Unsolved Mysteries, the original one. So it was in the public a little bit, but it was dropped fairly quickly. And to this day, we don't know exactly what happened.
Such a cool story.
And very cool story.
There are so many of them. Like, I think there were probably about 6 or 10 that were sort of in that ballpark where the descriptions were so so credible. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the big characteristics about the Canadian reports of those, the thousands that we talked about, a huge number of them were actually two witnesses, more than one witness, which is in this area is kind of a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, one of the things I produce every year is a Canadian UFO survey where I assemble all the Canadian UFO reports that are filed in a specific year. And over the years, every year has more than one witness. So it works out to like 1.8 if you average it out or something like that. So it's the typical cases where somebody is with another person and he or she nudges the other one and says, "Hey, did you see what I just saw?" So it does, attest to the fact that something physical was seen, or at least something was actually there that was seen.
Now, there was a part of if I got this right, I think it was near the end of your book, there was a possible piece of a spacecraft that crashed in Canada that was sold as junk and shipped to Japan. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of people that are really into, crashed saucers and pieces of crashed saucers. And there's even presentations at conferences about chunks of UFO that have been analyzed. In the case of the Falcon Lake one, by the way, there was a piece of metal that was analyzed and the radiation was analyzed by not just Canadian universities and institutions, but also University of Chicago. I think University of Arizona had a chunk of it. And in Canada, we've had several cases where pieces of things have been found, either directly related to a UFO sighting or a part. In the early 1960s, a large, large chunk, we're talking tons of material, were found on the shore of the Ottawa River. One piece was eventually, as you say, taken away as junk by a ship and given to Japan. Another chunk was brought to Ottawa and examined by a number of institutions. In fact, the National Defense National Research Council took a look at some of it. It was debated whether it was a piece from a spacecraft or something else. And for many years, it apparently sat on somebody's lawn in downtown Kanata or something like that until it's just vanished from history. But we have at least a few photographs of it. We have the results of metallurgical analyses. It's been lost to history, but these are parts of history that most Canadians aren't aware of. And it's so relevant today because this is exactly what people are interested in and want to hear about.
Now, part of it, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but from my recollection from your book, one of the problems or challenges, I guess, collecting this information and kind of having it out there in the public domain was something around bureaucracy in Canada. Like, they didn't know who should be responsible for this, and one department would try to offload it to another department. Because again, like, if you think way back, there's a stigma today. Back then, it was obviously bigger, and isn't that partly kind of how you got into this. You took on a lot of this role.
Yeah, and it was a hot potato, a very large hot potato, but a hot potato nevertheless, that nobody seemed to want to have anything to deal with it. In the United States, the view, prevailing view, in fact today, is that it's a military problem. It's a security issue. In Canada, the Royal Canadian Air Force had the responsibility for this. The National Defense at one point said, you know, it's not really our bailiwick that people are seeing these things. It seems to be more of a scientific exercise, because some of these might have related to meteors and satellites and so forth. So the RCAF handed it off to the National Research Council, which is a scientific body. And so, whereas in Canada it was a scientific body, United States, it wasn't the Smithsonian or the American Institute of Astronautics. It was the military that was looking into it. But because the National Research Council had responsibility, it was, you know, trying to understand the physical nature and to do some analyses. And, you know, at the same time, the public was demanding answers. Is it a spacecraft? Is it this? And, you know, when you bring a chunk of metal into a scientific lab and you say, is this from space or not? It's not as simple as running it through some gamma detector or something you see on TV. It's a little more complicated than that. You know, what we see on CSI Las Vegas did not exist in the 1960s. So it was a very complicated process. And the view was that flying saucers are nothing to worry about. The United States says people are just mistaken. So why should we expend any effort whatsoever? And yet the body of evidence that was accumulating was sort of demanding some sort of action. And so a few people took it under their wing to try and understand what the UFO phenomenon was all about. And unfortunately, they may not have had the full resources. They may not have had all the data they needed. And that's what we're trying to recover from. We're trying to recover from a lack of resources and scientific knowledge about what was really going on.
Hmm. Before we wrap up, I'd like to get your thoughts. You know, we're talking about alien craft possibly coming to our planet. I'd like to chat a little bit about us trying to get off this one. And Elon Musk, very polarizing figure. He's got his hand in a bunch of different industries. If you ask people about him at a cocktail party, half of them detest him, half of them love him. Given specifically the work that he's doing with SpaceX, what are your thoughts on this guy? And are you a fan or not?
Well, I mean, the fact that he sponsored some space flight, I have to give him credit for. the whole Twitter thing, I don't know. the fact that a lot of research into this type of field has to be funded by private individuals is something we've known about for some time, not just Elon, but there's a fellow named Robert Bigelow who was featured in the 60 Minutes special on UFOs a number of years ago, a millionaire or gazillionaire that's funding some research in this field. And that's been the case, for quite some time, where a lot of scientific research is being advanced by private industry. So I think that, even AIDS research, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, they're doing a tremendous job funding some groundbreaking research in medicine and the healthcare field. So the fact that we have to turn to private industry and private individuals for funding innovative and, you know, really speculative research is something that has to be applauded and encouraged. If Elon's listening, I could use a couple million for my research, just to, maybe it's pocket change or something you found in the cushions of your couch, but I could use that sort of stuff. We need funding for this. As a matter of fact, when I donated a lot of my material to the University of Manitoba research, they created a crowdfunding page to get people to help them fund what was going to be a very expensive, it has to be scanned, it has to be cataloged, a lot of material that has to be done. So they created a crowdfunding page that I think that they were aiming for, 15 or 20,000 or something like that. And I think they exceeded that quite easily because there are individuals who are fascinated with funding, research into UFOs. So I think that, the fact that that the public wants to know and that people with some resources want to help this out. You know, we have the Galileo Project funded partially by Harvard and Dr. Avi Loeb. There are other individuals who are pouring some money into this from other aspects. I think that it's an interesting situation where we're going to see more research, be coming forward, assisted by the private industry in conjunction with, let's say, the Pentagon. I know that there's at least a few UFO groups and individuals involved in UFO research who are going to be assisting the Pentagon or consulting the Pentagon. I was really recently brought on to as an affiliate of the Galileo Project to consult them on site placement and data analysis. So I think the fact that, we're going to be seeing a partnership between the private industry and government in this field is a very promising thing.
Any plans to start a UFO podcast? You've got 10 books under your belt, which congratulations for, but how about the podcast?
I've had that pointed out to me a couple of times. I don't have the time to do it. I'm actually busy doing the analyses. I get reports all the time. I'm being consulted quite a bit to sit down and do a regular podcast, chasing down guests and so forth. I don't have the time to do one myself, but I'll be happy to do an occasional podcast like yours from time to time.
Nice. If someone is just hearing about you for the first time and wants to dive into your body of work, what would be the, not to put you on the spot, what would be the first book that you think that they should start with?
Well, I think as a starting point, they could go to Canada's UFOs Declassified, which is the most recent one. It only documents cases up till the early 1980s. I'm working on another one because the sequel past that point. But that'll give you at least a taste of what's involved and some of the interesting cases and the reason why that you should pursue some additional reading in this field. I mean, as I say, I have 10 books out. I'm a presence on social media. I'm on Twitter. And Facebook. I'm actually an admin for a number of UFO groups. There's one called UFO Updates on Facebook that grew out of an actual forum long before Facebook. So I'm around, and check out my research. I also have a blog, which is uforum, U-F-O-R-U-M, at blogspot.com, where I publish a lot of material and commentary on what's going on in the UFO scene.
Awesome, and I encourage people to check you out. Before we go, I have a video clip I'd like to show you, and I'd like to get your take on it. Again, not to put you on the spot. I was out in my backyard just barbecuing some burgers or whatever in September of 2021, and I look up, and again, it's during the pandemic, everything was crazy. I look up, and there's this little triangle, a black triangle at the height of a jet going at a very high rate of speed, but it was moving in a really, really strange way. So I grabbed my phone. It's just like all the videos you see, super grainy, kind of blurry, but are you cool if I share it with you and just take a quick
sure
look?
Okay. Sure.
And for the people listening to this, I will post this on my Twitter feed so you can check it out. Okay, can you see this?
Yes.
All right. And I think I might, you'll hear me like kind of groaning because I'm bending backwards and I might drop an F-bomb at some point.
Okay. Oh, yeah. It's almost heart-shaped. Mm-hmm. And some of that is from, your camera movement, around, of course. Okay. Yeah.
And I tried it and it was going really fast, and I tried to get it to focus again, but it would not. Anyway, I found it strange that it looks kind of like an airplane, but it's moving, it's rotating in all these different directions, mm-hmm. but was going very fast. Okay, it went from one end of the horizon to the other in less than 30 seconds.
Hmm.
Anyway, what do you think? Am I crazy?
Well, yes, but that's a side point. I would have to, my first impression, and when I said it would look like a heart, is my first impression it was a balloon. And the reason I say that is we have got cases from time to time where specific shapes of balloons have gotten away from people. And some are, you know, heart-shaped. Indeed, some are shaped like numbers and letters, and some are just irregular. There's a classic one that's sort of shaped like a bat that turned out to be a Batman balloon, but we couldn't see the Batman logo on it and that type of thing. So, you know, my first impression, it was that it was a balloon. And yes, it was going very quickly, but, you know, it's hard to tell how high it was.
Yeah.
And the Airstream could have been zipping along really good at that time. So that's my first impression. If it was not that, you know, your guess is as good as mine.
Huh. Interesting. So last question before we wrap it up, given all this body of knowledge, all the work, the half century you've put into this, do you believe aliens are visiting our planet?
Well, there's absolutely no question that the truth is out there. Unfortunately, we're stuck down here. And, you know, I don't have any proof. I'm the Doubting Thomas that the aliens are visiting us. But at the same time, my astronomical background and my colleagues in astronomy both agree that there probably are aliens out there. There's civilizations where, you know, they probably have developed space travel. But we don't have the smoking gun. We don't have any absolute proof that aliens are visiting us. But, you know, we're discovering more and more exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system, every month, practically, some in habitable zones around other stars that are fairly close to us. And if one of those planets has a civilization, let's say the star around which this planet orbits has a bit of a head start on our own sun, let's say not just a thousand years, but 100,000 years. With that much of a head start, who knows what a civilization might be able to do in terms of bending the rules of physics, not breaking the laws of physics, but bending them in ways that we can't imagine. So it's possible that there are aliens visiting Earth, but we simply don't have the definite proof. And I don't think a grainy photo of a Tic Tac is necessarily going to be proof of that. But it's something that, you know, spurs the mind. We're living in the Steven Spielberg or the James Cameron universe now, where you know, taking it for granted that aliens are visiting us. So, you know, maybe it's good for us to think in those terms of our place in the universe.
Thanks for doing this work. Thanks for doing this research, writing these books, and thank you most of all for doing this podcast. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks again to Chris for taking the time to speak with me, and thanks to you for taking the time to listen. If you haven't had a chance to do so, please rate, review, or recommend the show. Helps other people to find this content. Thanks once again, and we'll see you next time.